Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 12th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for a science forum. And we have reassembled our panel of experts to answer your scientific questions. If you have one, call us. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. You can email as well. voxpop@wamc.org. That's voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 800-348-2551, the Science Forum, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Always fun when we reconvene the Science Forum and answer your science questions, and we're doing that right now. On the line with us today, Jim Pickett and Ed Stander. They are here to answer your questions, so if you have one, give us a shout. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. People have already done that, but we'll get to as many as we can. It's voxpop@wamc.org. Again, the phone number, and we have some open lines. 800-348-2551. Jim Pickett, welcome back, sir.
Well, it's good to be back.
All right, yeah. We had a little tough time tracking you down here in these COVID days, and you don't see people in person, but we got you, and you're here with the show, and that's great. Just tell us briefly, for those who have not listened before, your areas of expertise.
Well, I'm a mostly retired organic chemist.
All right.
But I've read science widely and willing to offer my opinions on most anything.
All right. Also with us is Ed Stander. And Ed, once again, we know that you're also willing to answer anything about anything. But what is your area of...
I'm not retired, so I can answer anything.
What's your area of expertise?
Geology, astronomy, environmental science, and, of course, anything Jim can't answer.
By the way, did you see any of the meteor shower over the past couple of days when it was nice out?
Yeah. I went out a couple of nights and saw one or two fireballs. The torrids are winding down, but the Leonids are coming up, so it's a good month for them.
We were really looking forward to those couple of really nice, warmish nights, and it was very clear. We said, okay, the torrids, we hear they are very long trails, and they go on for a while. I think I saw a very quick one. My wife saw a quick one. Nobody else saw one. So it was a bit of a letdown where we were, but I'm glad you saw a few. A couple of emails have come in here, guys, and then we will hit a news item I saw, and then we'll probably go to the phones. This one came in a while ago from Tim in Ulster County. Tim says, this is an easy one. Well, we'll find out. Just wondering if spraying vinegar on my glass shower door after showering will prevent or get rid of hard water stains. Would that help? And that's from Tim.
The vinegar might might help a little, but it's really not a strong enough acid to get the lime off well. Using some product that contains citric acid is usually more effective.
So if Tim were to spray, say, grapefruit juice on his shower, it would be all right, yeah?
Well, lemon juice might be better. But there's all sorts of products in the store that contain citric acid that are to clean hard water.
But vinegar's just not quite strong enough.
No. It'll work a little, but it's a tough way to go.
All right. This email from Ramon in Montgomery. Ramon writes, how is it that photons do not suffer from entropy? How is it that over eons of traveling, they do not slow down but maintain their energy level? The photons reaching us now from the visible edge of the universe are billions of years old, yet maintain their speed. And what principle or axiom of physics explains or permits this freedom from entropy? Ramon writes that, and very beautifully written. Ed, you take the first crack.
Boy, isn't that a great question. Boy, I honestly wish that we knew exactly why. But basically the idea is that photons don't have any mass. And as a result, they don't have any reason to be slowing down. There's no frictional component to them. So there's nothing to interact with them to make them slow down. So there's no reason why they should.
It's very interesting, this whole business of light. Photons are theoretically particles, right? But they don't have mass. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, they behave like particles under some circumstances.
Right.
And behave like waves in other circumstances.
Are they, as far as we know, the only things that do that?
No, actually, everything does that.
Really? Am I a wave function, too?
Yes, you are.
Amazing. All right, this email from Greg. Greg writes to us from, it's like Staten Island, New York. We had a full moon on Halloween, but no one made a big deal about it. I was wondering, how often does that occur? Isn't a full moon on Halloween relatively rare? When will the next one be? And that's from Greg.
Well, it wasn't just a full moon, but it was also a blue moon. It was the second moon of the month.
Right.
So that happens very rarely. But as far as happening, you know, on Halloween, the moon takes 29 and a half days approximately to go around the Earth, and a month is on average 30 days. So if you do the calculations, it happens quite often. It's not that much of a variation because all you have to have is a full moon at some time between midnight and the next day at midnight.
You know,
so that half day doesn't play much of an effect.
Do either of you know why? And I remember hearing this long ago, and I heard it again this past October, that the second full moon is the blue moon. Why blue? Why did they call it blue?
Otherwise, you couldn't name a song about it.
There's all sorts of folklore about that, I guess, but I don't know if there's a real definitive answer.
Okay, fair enough. Jim Pickett and Ed Stander here on the Science Forum. Our number is 800-348-2551, and as the phones light up here, we will get to them shortly. This caught my eye in Science News, and this is from sciencenews.com. This crossed October 14th, so I'm sure you both have heard about this. The first room temperature superconductor has finally been found. It can do its business at 59 degrees Fahrenheit, which is quite a bit higher than superconductors in the past. Have either of you seen this news?
Yeah. The asterisk on that is that it is under enormous pressure.
Yeah.
So,
why is that an asterisk?
Well, because it's not anything that's going to be turned into wires anytime soon. It is a laboratory curiosity at this point.
Ed, before we go too far with superconductivity, explain
yes.
to us who know very little about it, just basically what it is.
I can't actually define it simply, but basically the idea is that a superconductor has nearly perfect efficiency of electrical conductivity.
So there's no resistance, basically.
There's almost no resistance, if there's any whatsoever.
All right, then, Jim, why is it a big deal? I guess this one isn't such a big deal since it's under enormous pressure, but why would it be a great thing if we had room temperature superconductivity?
Because then power transmission could be much more efficient than it is now. You could send electricity from one side of the country to the other with negligible loss. So that would be a big deal for efficiency of the grid and using renewables and all sorts of stuff.
Let's take a quick break. Oh, go ahead, Ed.
And of course, it's also true that if we develop superconductors, we'd have also much, much faster computers. Because that's one of the things that slows down effectively the operation of a computer.
Interesting. Let's take a break here. Ed Stander and Jim Pickett here on the Science Forum to answer your questions. And we'll do just that. We'll hit the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop. It's the Science Forum. It's Ray Graff, joined today by Jim Pickett and Ed Stander. You can call us at 800-348-2551 if you have a science question. And let's go to Wellington, Connecticut. And Patrick, you're on.
Yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Hi.
Recently saw a program about some studies where they were using some nuclear isotopes on plants. And the connectivity within, like, the root system between, you know, if a tree got cut down, the other plants felt it. And even as a field ecologist, I'm always looking at, you know, ways that things are connected and how to apply that to our human life. And even with mycology, how the psyllium is all very connected under the earth and we don't see it. So I guess, you know, reflecting on it, it's like, how can we take, you know, our examples in the natural world and really apply that to our human life and society? I can take the question off air.
All right, Patrick, thanks a lot. Who wants this one, guys?
Wow. The only thing I would say is that connectivity of human life, we're in it right now with the internet and all the communications ways and we're doing it. It effectively, it's the same sort of thing that's going on with mycelium. There's a mushroom called the, what is it called? Anyway, there's mushrooms. There's a type of tree, for example, that's the largest human, the largest creature in existence because of all the roots connecting together with each other. And connectivity, if you consider it that way, we're connected totally by the internet now, and how that affects us as human beings, probably in much the same way that that trees are connected by roots and the mycelium of these mushrooms are connected.
All right. Well, great question. Jim, would you like to weigh in on that?
Well, just to mention that it's virtually a whole field of studying networks. There has been serious study of that for a very long time.
Let's go to Oneonta and Gail. Gail, you're on.
Hi. Once before, I talked to the Science Forum, and they told me I was asking them about UVC light and disinfecting things, and they said that I would have to be careful because of cataracts. Well, I know sunglasses protect you from the sunshine from getting cataracts, so I'm wondering if that would work with UVC light.
Yeah, the UVC would not make it through sunglasses, but that said, it can make it around sunglasses. So in the lab, photochemists and people working with lasers or UV light use goggles that stick very closely around your eyes so that no stray light gets in.
They also use special glass so that you don't have to use sunglasses, for example. Just regular glass will work, provided that it's UV protected.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
So depending on the plastic that the sunglasses are made of, it will absorb UVC, those wavelengths of ultraviolet. Usually additives have to be put in to block the UVB and UVA. But the backbone of the plastic itself, in many cases, not all, but in many cases, absorb the UVC. But again, that doesn't make it safe unless you really have goggles that fit tightly against the face.
All right, Gail, thank you very much for that one. The Science Forum in full gear here. Ed Stander and Jim Pickett ready to answer your questions at 800-348-2551. Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Ed, I got a question, two questions for you. The spy planes that we used to fly, the TR-1 and the U-2 and SR, did they ever make contrails?
Well, any jet will make a contrail, because all that's happening with a contrail is that you're taking You're taking air and you're compressing it as it goes into the jet. And when it comes out, it expands. And when it expands, it cools off. And the contrail is effectively just water vapor. But because of expanding, it's cooled off and formed ice crystals. So there's no reason why it shouldn't form contrails, provided that it's flying at a low enough altitude to be within the atmosphere. Now, many of these planes were flying at much higher altitudes, and as such, any contrail they produce would be very, very small and would disappear very quickly.
Yeah, because it's a matter of having the conditions to make it and then to persist.
All right.
And, Ed's right. If the really high where atmospheric pressure is very, very low, the contrail would just evaporate.
Chris, thank you for the call. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. If you have a question for the experts, Nick is in Middletown. Nick, you're on.
Hello. I remember a time back reading in Scientific America the theoretical existence of a particle known as a graviton. And I was just wondering what the status was with that particle. You know, is it more than just a theory? Is there a very strong indication that the particle exists? And if it does, like other particles, is there reason to believe it could be a thing called an anti-graviton?
Ah, good question. Anybody have an
answer? Do you want to take that?
Well, as far as I know, a graviton has not been identified. Physicists like to use the model of particles to transfer forces for fields interacting with each other. As a chemist, I find that to be a little bit confusing and baffling, but I don't think gravitons are really a thing that's been identified, and I don't believe that there's any way to have an anti-graviton, but I'm talking way out of my expertise here.
Yeah, the only evidence that gravitons exist, apart from the fact that gravity exists, is that during gravitational waves, which we're now measuring to some extent when they come through, there's sort of a jittering associated with it, and some people are suggesting that that's caused by gravitons within the wave. But there's no distinct evidence that they actually exist.
Yeah, and to have negative gravity, that would imply negative mass, which there's speculation about, but I don't think that's a thing either.
Hmm. All right. Well, Nick, thank you for the call. It's the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Ed Stander and Jim Pickett join us today. Greg is in Westford. Greg.
Hey there. I just want to get off speaker.
Great.
Thanks for your great station. And
thanks.
I just wanted to correct one of the guys who said earlier about that Halloween. This one that just happened had nothing to do with the peanut blue moon, but it was the first full moon on Halloween in all time zones since 1944.
Wow.
So it was quite rare. My question, though, just talking about those meteor showers, mm-hmm. I saw one the other night, and I've always heard that, you know, stars, everything's so far away, by the time you're seeing the light, could be years old. So I'm wondering, so if I saw a meteor the other night, how long ago did it actually shoot across the sky before I saw the light down here on Earth?
Probably milliseconds, because what a meteor is a small particle of rock or something like that, or ice, entering our Earth's atmosphere. And as it burns up, uh-huh. That's what causes the meteor. In fact, it's sort of a weird term if you think about it. Meteor comes from the same root as meteorology, which is the study of the weather, mm-hmm. or the study of the atmosphere. So a meteor is actually an atmospheric event, which means that when you see it, it's happening. The amount of time it takes for it to get to your eyes, the atmosphere sort of becomes thick enough at about 50 miles up to start meteors forming. So the light from that meteor is probably less than 50 miles away from you.
Uh-huh. And so So that makes sense, because the star is so much closer than anything we're seeing out there in the universe. But many don't ever or never reported to have hit the Earth?
Because the average size of a meteoroid, or the things out in space, is about the size of a grain of wheat or a grain of rice. And so they usually burn up before they ever get anywhere near the Earth. Also, when they come in, they very rarely come straight down. They shoot across the sky because they're sort of skipping off the top of the atmosphere. So by the time, they just disappear. They evaporate, if you will. On the other hand,
so I guess it would take a very heavy one to break through and come straight at the planet, maybe.
Right, but what you can do, and this is really pretty cool, is if you take a bottle of put it outside during a meteor shower, and then the day after, or a couple days after, take a magnet, wrap it up in plastic, and put it in the bottle. You can actually capture some of the little pieces of the meteorites as they came in. So these particles actually come in, and they're small by the time they get here, of course, because they've all burnt up. But you can sometimes get pieces of them, especially, for example, if you have a gutter and you collect the water from the gutter, so you're collecting all the water off your roof.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, they're really here. Cool stuff. It's very small.
All right.
Really cool stuff. Love science. It's truth, and science rules. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Greg. This is fascinating, Ed. So if I were to take a bucket and put it outside, theoretically, I could catch some star stuff.
That's right.
But you don't really have to be in the middle of a meteor shower to do that, right? This stuff's falling all the time, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's something like 11,000 pounds or 11,000 tons coming in pretty well every day. But, of course, that's over the entire Earth. During a meteor shower, there's more of it coming in, so the chances are you'll get more of it as well. But, yeah, if you put a bucket down and just keep on collecting over a month or two, guaranteed if you put a magnet in there, you'll get little pieces of meteorite stuck on the magnet.
That is so cool. I'm going to do that. Now, you said the Taurids, they're wrapping up. I think the 5th through the 12th was supposed to be the peak time.
Right.
And you said the Leonids are coming next?
That's right.
When?
Oh, I'll tell you in a second.
All right. We'll wait.
Let's see. The Leonids.
Yeah. Okay.
November 17th is the peak.
Oh, all right. It'll be very soon. Now, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, my wife and I had limited success in looking for Taurid meteors the last few nights. Maybe we were looking in the wrong direction. Do we know which direction they generally go in the sky?
You'll like this. They come from the area around Taurus the bull.
Right.
And Leonids come from the area of Leo the lion.
Right. Well, now, okay, they come from that direction, but direction do they fly in the sky when you're looking?
Okay. Generally speaking, it's relatively late at night or early in the morning is when the Taurids come up, and the Leonids as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, it all depends, of course, on where the moon is. If the moon is up, you can't see a bloody thing. So you have to have the right environment to be able to see them.
I guess my question is, do they go willy-nilly, or do they all follow a general path across the sky?
They all come from a particular location,
right,
and then they spread out from that. The best way to think of it is, imagine when you're in a car, you're driving along during a rainstorm. The raindrops seem to be coming from a particular direction is sort of spreading out towards you, right?
Yep.
That's the same thing with the meteors. The reason that they do that is because that's the direction we're moving. So as we move through a cloud of dust, usually formed by a comet, originally formed by a comet, as you're going through it, as the Earth is going through it at 75,000 miles an hour, they seem to be coming at us, and they sort of spread out from that direction.
Yeah, I got you.
So during the Taurids, we're going in the direction of Taurus. During the Leonids, we're going in the direction of Leo.
Right.
And that's why they come from that area.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett and Ed Stander are guests today on the panel. Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
I was talking with a friend this last week, and he told me something that I thought he was wrong. It sounded counterintuitive. But he mentioned that, you know, the planets have different masses, and people would weigh different if they were on the surface of the planet. But he said these numbers don't necessarily correspond. For example, on Saturn, Saturn is 95 times as massive as Earth. So you'd think a 100-pound person would weigh 100 times 95. But on another website, it said they'd only weigh 107 pounds on the surface. Mm-hmm. And I know there's and Mercury, on the other hand, is only 1/20th of the mass of the Earth, but a 100-pound person would weigh 90 pounds on Mercury. And I know there's a difference in density, but I didn't think weight and mass depended on density. So does anybody have an explanation for that, please?
Well, yeah. part of it is you have to consider the center of gravity. The closer you are to the center of gravity, the heavier you are. So if you have a very large planet whose density is not very high, you'll weigh less than you would, for example, on a rocky planet where you could be closer to the center of gravity.
Okay, so it's not the density per se, but it's the distance from the core.
From the core, exactly.
The radius.
Okay,
go ahead, Jim.
It's an inverse square law. So as you move away from the center, your weight would drop quickly.
Okay, so it's a matter of being on the surface of the planet. I think I understand. That makes sense. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Richard, thanks for the call. Ed Stander and Jim Pickett join us today on the Science Forum. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And let's go to Rachel in Wappingers. Rachel.
Hi. I am calling because I'm wondering about when I'm lying in bed in the middle of the night, sometimes I hear a sound or I hear something hit my window. Nobody has driven by on the street. Nothing is going on. It's completely silent. And I always wondered, is that a particle coming down from the atmosphere, like what you're talking about, like a piece of a meteor, something, some tiny grain that's hit my window because nothing's going on?
Maybe a bug?
It would seem unlikely that it would be something large enough. It would be a meteor that would be large enough to make an audible clunk on the window. I think Ray mumbled bug. The bug would be what would come to my mind.
You know, Jim, I'm a professional radio broadcaster. I don't mumble too much.
Bug
very well. But you're right. Could it be anything else, Ed? Could it be bits of flotsam and jetsam from airplanes or whatever?
Oh, the only thing I could think of it might be would be thermal expansion or contraction of the window pane.
Oh.
If it's not something actually hitting it, it could be the window pane or within the wood around the window pane that's actually expanding and contracting that could cause that.
How close are you to the road, Rachel?
Very close, and it sounds just like when you're driving and a rock hits your, you know, something hits your windshield, it just goes, it has that sound. It's a percussive pop in the glass. It's a tight sound.
I mean, could it be a tiny little stone that maybe a tire kicks up and just throws it up in the air high enough to hit your window?
But nobody's driving by. Nope, nothing. It's completely silent.
Interesting.
And then pop, this thing, like, it hits the window.
Huh. I would go for thermal contraction myself.
Okay.
It could be that you're developing a stress in the glass, and it releases to some extent. Are they old windows or new windows? Are they double pane or single pane?
That's a great question. I'm not sure, and I don't. They're certainly probably 15 years old, but they were new back then. They're not ancient windows, as far as I know. Could it have to do with if it's contraction? Could it have to do with the weather, like as it gets cooler and cooler in the night?
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, if when it gets really, really cold, like 20 below zero, then your house makes all sorts of noises. As it contracts.
Right, but this is in the summer, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's expansion then from the heat. It's all possible. The trick is you'd have to look at try and look at the temperature when it happens. Look at other things. Something coming from outer space is unlikely, because by the time it gets down here, you're talking about something that's so small that it's slowed down because of friction with the atmosphere. So it wouldn't have enough energy to actually make a click, let alone a thump.
Rachel, we got to take a break here, but thank you for the call. Jim Pickett and Ed Standard join us on the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And I'll tell you what, guys, we got some great emails coming up. We'll hit the email bag in a moment. Booker T and the MGs here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett and Ed Stander are here to answer your questions. And some good email here. First of all, you guys remember that email early on from Ramon talking about photons and entropy?
Yep.
Okay, well, he's taking you guys to task. He says, answer sort of was no answer and opened up another question. Please follow up. In reply to the photon entropy question, it was stated that very thing operates as both particles as waves, and then that circles back to the question. Everything else undergoes entropy, but photons get a pass. But even if talking waves, they do run out of energy and continuously get weaker until they cease to be detectable. Waves undergo entropy, but answer was that photons have no matter, which waves also do not, yet they are immune to entropy. Is science just punting on this one? And that's from Ramon.
I think Ramon is misidentifying entropy a bit, because so the photon can travel indefinitely through space without losing energy, but everything else can too. So if you threw a baseball from the planet Krypton, it would proceed without losing energy until it ran into something. If it doesn't run into anything, it'll proceed forever. So entropy involves collections of stuff. A single thing really doesn't obey laws of entropy. So an individual in photons don't interact with each other. So until they encounter something they can interact with, entropy doesn't really make sense.
Now, but I have heard, Ed, and maybe you have heard this as well, or Jim, that, and for the life of me, I have no idea how this works, but you can theoretically slow down light.
Yes, you slow it down. Well, yeah, I mean, anytime light going through a piece of glass slows down.
But and that's because of interactions.
Right. But it doesn't lose energy. And when it comes out from the other side of the glass, it has the same energy that it had when it went in. Mm.
I think this is a whole show, so we'll have to go to the next email. This is from Patrick in North Adams. Patrick says, can anyone explain AC polarity? DC polarity, simple to understand. I work in the electric utility world. Transformers in a substation are typically subtractive polarity, while the transformers on the street are additive polarity. What would happen if the transformers were either all additive or all subtractive? And that's from Patrick in North Adams.
Wow, that's out of my bailiwick. How about yourself, Jim?
Yep, nope. I can't do that one. We need our resident electrical.
All right, Roger Giovanni will have to do that the next time he's back. So I'll tell you what, Patrick, you save that until the next Science Forum that Roger's on, and he'll figure it out for you. This is from Amanda, who wanted Ed to know that there's at least one former mediocre student laughing at his dad's jokes on the show today. There you go. You know this person, then, I take it.
Oh, yes.
All right. This one's from Dave. Dave, subject heading, window frost and fern structure. Why so similar? I didn't know that.
Well, they're both dendritic structures. What ice crystals ice crystals have a fast-growing direction and a slow-growing direction. And the fast-growing direction, they're called the A direction, and there's effectively three of them at 60 degrees apart. So that's what forms a snowflake. And those areas are fast-growing directions, if you want, because there's lots of places for new ice to form, to connect onto. Mm-hmm. And so the fern structures form effectively because there are directions where they can form easiest. So you get one A direction forming the major part of the fern, and then the other two A directions form the branches coming off the side of it.
Huh. Jim, you want to add anything to that?
Nope, that sounds good to me.
This email from Jay. Jay says, how long after the birth of the universe were stars born? Is it possible for so many stars to die off at once, making the universe a lot darker? And that's from Jay.
Well, the it's hard to see stars at the edge of the universe because it's so far away. It's 13. Well, it's a lot further. Actually, the edge of the universe is a lot further than 13.85 billion light years away. You can see structures at the edge of the universe. You can see galaxies and galactic clusters, but you can't see stars themselves. So to say that the stars are forming at that point is very, very difficult. In fact, one of the things we know about the Big Bang is that it produced a lot of hydrogen and helium. And hydrogen and helium are very light. So these first stars, when they formed, what they're called first-generation stars, would have been absolutely huge, monster things. And we've been looking for them for years, trying to find stars that are only made out of hydrogen and helium and not made of all the other elements that form when a star blows up and forms from itself.
Right.
So at the moment, we don't really know exactly when they form. They probably form relatively early, but it's not, it's for myself anyway, I don't think you can say exactly when they form from the time the universe first formed.
So interesting.
Yeah, see, according to scientificamerican.com, all systems capable of forming stars should have appeared between 100 and 250 million years after the Big Bang.
Hmm.
And to Ed's point, if the first stars were really big, then they would burn out pretty quickly.
Right.
So their lifetime would be short. The implication in the question that a whole bunch of stars will die all of a sudden, that the lifetime of a star depends on its mass. The heavy stars burn out quickly. So big stars, little stars, medium-sized stars formed all the time. So when the big ones burn out, there are lots of other ones that are still around.
Right. In fact, some of the youngest ones, the smallest stars, the brown dwarfs and such, will probably be around for 100 billion years.
Hmm.
So they're going to be around for a long time. Good place to build a house.
This one is from Kay in Cornwallville. Oh, boy, you guys have been getting some great email questions here. All right, good luck. Kay writes, I'm no mathematician, but can you speak a little more to the idea that photons have no mass, yet they still have energy, given E equals mc squared? Not that I understand the physics behind the theory. How can something with no mass have energy? If energy is the product of two variables, and one of those variables is zero, how can the energy of a massless particle be anything other than zero? Again, I'm no mathematician. I'm not even a particle physicist. And that's from Kay in Cornwallville.
You want to take it, Jim?
Not really.
All right. Well, you guys can punt on this if you want.
Well, we can say a couple things. We can say, first of all, that in the E equals mc squared formula, it can either be energy or mass. It doesn't have to be this. They're commutable, but it could be one or the other. And you might ask, how much energy can you put on the head of a pin? And the answer is an infinite amount of energy. So you can have a lot of energy in a photon, yet it doesn't have to have mass.
Yeah, and under certain photons can act as if they have mass. I mean, you could explain at least part of the gravity bending photons by asserting some mass to the photon. The photons in the universe, again, because of E equals MC squared, the photons in the universe contribute to the overall mass of the universe.
So then they have mass.
Well,
they can have mass. Well, no, they can't have mass.
They can act like they have mass, but by definition, things which travel at the speed of light cannot have mass. Because anything that has mass that tries to travel at the speed of light would have infinite mass. So the problem, I think, is applying these macro scale kind of concepts that we have as to what mass is, that a particle is like a BB, really don't apply when you get to things like photons and stuff down in the quantum realm.
Aren't you glad we found you right before the show, Jim? Aren't you happy about that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was happily working, arranging stuff on my workbench like old guys are supposed to do.
Well,
I'm very happy you're here, Jim, because that way I can't make mistakes.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I need an Excedrin or a bourbon or both. Here we go. This one's from Carl. Oh, my heavens. Any thoughts about if entanglement holds together over the event horizon? Good luck. Oh, my heavens. Whatever.
I'm going to go take a nap. Jim, you can take that one, okay?
No, I have no idea about that.
All right. Well, let's just move on then and cut our losses. This one's from Edward. How does atmosphere enter a pressurized gas line, helium at 100 psi, that has a pinhole leak? And that's from Edward.
I'm sorry, what is the question?
How does atmosphere enter a pressurized gas line, helium at 100 psi, that has a pinhole leak? I think the question is, if the pressure is higher inside
than outside.
Yeah.
I don't see how it can happen. In fact, generally speaking, that's the saving grace of things that contain hydrogen, is that it's very difficult to mix oxygen if the hydrogen's under pressure with it, and therefore it's very unlikely to blow up.
All right. I tell you what, one more email here, and then we just...
Please, these are great emails.
This one's from Ashley. Ashley says, I have a question about geology. All right, Ed, stand by for this. My friend lives in Schoharie County and find these interesting shaped stones called concretions in riverbeds. I'm wondering how they are formed. If you haven't seen pictures of them, they're so bizarre looking. They're perfectly and geometrically shaped stones that look like they were man-made but are occurring naturally. And that's from Ashley.
Well, Ashley, basically there's two things going on with the concretions. The first is that Schoharie Valley used to be underwater during the time of the glaciers. It was underwater, and dirt from the glaciers would go into that lake and fall down to the bottom. And depending on whether it was winter or summer, the amount of clay would be different. And so in Schoharie Valley, you'll see that there are clay layers. In fact, if you go to House Caverns, towards the back of it, you'll actually see a clay that looks like it's stepped, and that's because of these clay layers. And so the reason that the concretions, first of all, have layers is because you're going from a high clay layer to a low clay layer to a high clay layer. And when they get rounded by water, they tend to erode differently. The reason the concretions form themselves is because fluids going through the clay get attracted by particles that are in the clay. For example, little pieces of iron or other things like that. And they sublimate out. They come out of solution and harden around those particles. So inside the concretion itself, there's usually a very small particle that acts as the nucleus for the concretion. So you can imagine that you have all this clay, and then there's a little particle there. Something comes up. They start attracting around it. They collect around it. And then as water runs over the top of it, it erodes away all the stuff that's not hard, leaving the hard stuff behind. That's the concretion.
Interesting. All right, one guy here in Gardner, Massachusetts, has been waiting a very long time. Leo You have a couple of minutes here. Go ahead.
Okay, real quick. This is how to catch meteors. Mm-hmm. I was at Stellafane, which is a convention of astronomers, and on the very top of this mountain in the middle of the day was this old astronomer with a large group of kids around, and he was displaying how to catch meteors. And what you want to do is get yourself something about like a cat box and then put it in a black plastic bag and push the bag down and put about an inch or two of water in there. And the water is so the meteorites don't bounce out.
Right.
And leave it there for a couple of hours, a couple of days, a couple of weeks. But these tiny meteors are raining down constantly. And the ones that you see zipping through the sky and then they burn out, they flutter down as a little tiny piece of dust. And that's what you're catching. And you can tell that they're meteors because they're teardrop-shaped, and it looks like they made a very hot reentry. And the way you collect them out of the little cat box-like affair that you made with the water in it is you get a magnet, and you put a plastic bag over it, and you sweep the magnet back and forth and back and forth, and it will collect all of the iron meteorites.
Huh.
And then you take the plastic bag and a Petri dish, and you pull the magnet out of the bag, and then you kind of gently wash the outside of that plastic bag in the water and in the Petri dish, and you will see little tiny grains. And it's best if you have a microscope or a really good magnifying glass, but for some of these you don't need any magnification.
Amazing.
And it's really cool. And the non-iron meteorites, you're going to have to collect a bunch of them, like from a drain pipe.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have to look at it with a microscope. And you can tell, once again, that they made a very hot reentry because they're all teardrop-shaped. Some of them are popped and are hollow.
Yeah.
So,
well, we're out of time
here,
Leo.
That's how you do it.
Thanks a lot. You know, it's funny. I've seen many vaguely teardrop-shaped things in our cat box at home, but pretty sure they're not meteorites. I'm not sure. Ed and Jim, thank you guys for being here. We're done here.
It's a pleasure.
Time for a nap, eh? Yes. All right, back to your workbench there, Jim. Thanks for being here.
Okay, my pleasure.
Support comes from the Hyde Collection, featuring two new exhibits, J.S. Woolley, Photographer, and Images of the People, Russian Lacquer Painting, by appointment only, hydecollection.org. Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond since 1996, imediaconsult.com. And Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever, agstewardship.org. Once again, thanks to Jim Pickett and Ed Stander for being with us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls and for the truly, truly powerful email we had today on the program. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Joe Makowicz took the calls. Our producer, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we welcome back Food Friday. And haven't we missed it, lo, these many months? We'll talk about delicious baked goods. We may even try a couple. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Capital Connection.